fellowship before our feature speaker. Okay, and now apparently I will be the 10-minute speaker. And again, I'm Catherine, and I'm an alcoholic. And first, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to come and share a little bit, about 10 minutes worth, which is always hard for me to do, a little bit of my spirit strength and hope with you guys. And I want to thank my husband, David, for asking me to be his warm-up person, because he's the feature speaker, and he's somebody that, you know, when I first got into recovery, I was told to listen to those people that had a message that I wanted and something that provided a solution, and that's what I did. And he was actually one of them that I got to hear when I first got into recovery talk about a solution to my problem. You know, my sobriety date is 4/3/1995, and I was 30 years old when I made it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't come here by choice. I came in kicking and screaming and very angry, and I did not want to be one of you guys at all. I didn't think I was one of you guys. In fact, I was here to prove to you that I was not one of you. And what led me into the rooms was the idea that I was 11 years old, and I had started to pick up my first drink. By the time I was 11, I had already figured out that I did not belong. I felt out of place, including also in my own family. I came from a military family. We moved a lot, so I never really fit in anywhere. It was always hard for me to try to gain new friends and to fit into the groups that had been going to school together since they were 12, you know, since they were kids, and it was hard for me. And with this fear that I think I was just born with in the first place, I was afraid of everything, that, and I just was so afraid that I was never good enough, that I think by the time I was 11 and somebody offered me that first drink, and when I took it, I can remember it going down, and I can remember how good it felt, and I can remember feeling that immediate relief, that idea of going, oh, okay, everything feels good. And I can remember that feeling, and I can also remember that feeling of getting drunk that first night and thinking, I want to do this again, because I liked passing out. I liked that feeling. I liked the effect that alcohol produced in me. And so from the age of 11 until I was 30 when I got sober, I pretty much drank or was mood altered in some form or fashion on a daily basis. I was not drunk every day or falling down drunk, and most people didn't even know something was wrong with me until I was out really partying. But I was always having something in me so that I felt like I can deal with life, so I could always get that sense of relief, so I could always just go, okay, I can face this world and I can face myself. And so I did that throughout junior high school, college, and it gave me, I loved it when I came into AA, and it said, and I heard somebody say, because I could relate to it, and they said it gave me that liquid courage. And that's exactly what alcohol did for me. It gave me that courage to be able to go be a pom-pom girl and to go up and sing in the choir and to do all those things that I saw other people do that I never had in me to do on my own. I never felt I was good enough. And alcohol did for me, like, it made me feel prettier, made me feel, you know, more special. It made me feel like I could fit in. And but my problem was that I could never just have one. My whole life, I was never capable, and I didn't recognize that. I never noticed that I was never just having one drink. That was beyond my power to do that. And it didn't really affect me. I wasn't one of the, in the terms of, you know, you hear people talk about getting the handcuffs put on them. That was not me. You know, I never got a DUI. I was never put in jail. I was never suspended from school. I actually graduated from college, and I went off to get a career, and I did that, and I made my way up a corporate ladder, and I worked in an office, had my own office, wore a suit, carried a briefcase, but I would do weird things like this. In my head, I would think things like, I'm not a drunk driver, because I would drink before I drove, I would drink after I drove, but never while I was driving. So I just never considered myself a drunk driver. I never liked drinking by myself, because if you drank by yourself, then you have a problem, and I didn't want to face that. So, or I didn't know I didn't want to face it. I just knew that if you drank by yourself, you'd have a problem. So I just was like, okay, I'll always drink with someone. So I made sure up until the very end that I always drank with someone, including even if I had to finally go up to the end when I was drinking out in the bars by myself, myself, I would take my briefcase with me, open it up, and pretend like I was working because I didn't want anybody to know I was drinking by myself. And you know, the biggest person I fooled was myself. I didn't realize I was actually drinking by myself. I didn't even actually realize I was drinking in bars because they were dance clubs. I was dancing. They were sports bars. I was watching sports. They were jazz clubs. I was listening to the music. You know, I just always pictured an alcoholic as someone sitting in a bar at the table with the peanut shells on the floor and doing that. And that wasn't my story, but I certainly drank exactly like the picture I had in my head of an alcoholic. Because I could never just drink one, and it slowly but surely took everything from me. By the end, it took my sanity. It took my weight. I weighed 95 pounds at the very most on a good day. It took a lot of my spirit. It definitely took my self-respect. And it led me to a place that was very ugly, dark, and self-hatred. And I lost, and now that was just me losing me. But I also lost other things like a husband, a house, a child, all my money, and my job. And the crazy part of that was I didn't realize I had a problem. I just always thought I had a problem with behavior. I didn't realize I had an actual problem with drinking. And I was 29, and I was getting ready to turn 30, and somebody had said, oh, you know how they do it. It's like, oh, no biggie, you got a whole life ahead of you. You're only going to be 30. They were trying to make me feel better that I was turning 30. And the only thing that went through my head was, I don't think I can do this anymore. Not drink anymore, but live anymore. I was so done with living. I'd go to bed wishing that I wouldn't wake up, and I'd be so angry when I did wake up because I didn't know how I was going to face another day. Because I was just miserable. So my best idea was to kill myself. And that didn't obviously work. But it did land me into a mental institution. It took me about 10 years to understand that, you know, the jails, institution, or death, that I was actually in an institution. One day, all of a sudden, I said, in mental institution, I was like, oh, no. I was actually in a mental institution. That's an institution. I am part of you guys. And I was kind of bummed. And so, but it did land me in a mental institution. But I came out still not understanding how much of it, that I was crazy. I mean, I was insane. But I got led into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous through a guy that I met in the institution, and he was on a court card, and he led me in here saying, you can go in there and they'll prove that you're, they'll let you know if you're an alcoholic. So I came in here to have you guys tell me that I wasn't one. But thank God you guys took one look at me and you said, welcome, keep coming back. And you were laughing and you were having fun, and you certainly didn't feel like I did, and you certainly didn't look like me. And, because you were happy, and I wasn't. I was dark. And what I heard, one of the things that I heard was about the hole in the soul. And when I was in that mental institution, I was trying to tell the doctor about how I had this dark, empty hole inside of me, like I could feel it. And he didn't know what I was talking about, but I come into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys knew exactly what I was talking about. And I related to that as well. And so what happened was, not only did I learn how to not drink here, because I learned how to stay abstinent through the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous by finding a God of my understanding who filled up that hole inside of me. I no longer have to use alcohol or drugs to fill me up, to make me feel okay, to make me feel like I don't want to die. And you guys have given me a way to live life. You know, I don't feel less than anymore. I don't feel like I don't fit in. I do on occasion, you know, but it's not a habitual thing. It's not like I need something to take care of that for me anymore. You guys, I found a solution in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous through the steps. By working the steps and finding that God, because the purpose of the Big Book is to find a God of my own understanding that's going to lead me to a way of life that I've never been able to do on my own. It's not just about the drinking. It's not just about the alcohol. Alcohol is actually not my problem today. Today, my problem is how am I going to live each day without making a mess out of my life, self-destruct myself, or ruin yours. And this step, this program, has actually afforded me back a husband. It's given me back a home. It's given me back my son. It's given me back a relationship with my mother. But I'll tell you, more importantly, outside of all of that, if it only had given me back my self-respect and filling up that hole that I had inside of me and me feeling like I'm happy today and that I don't want to kill myself, that would have been enough. you know, because God has provided everything for me and more than I ever dreamt that was going to be ever possible. So I'm going to close with this. I want to thank you again for allowing me to participate in my own recovery, and I want to thank you for allowing me to stay sober one more day just by you sitting out there as part of my alcoholic guy over there. Okay, so again, I'm Catherine, alcoholic, and tonight I get the pleasure of being the one, and I didn't know I was going to get to do this, and I'm really excited that I get to introduce you to David, who is from Visalia, and he has gotten his 27 years this year, this month.
My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you guys hear me back there?
Oh, yeah.
They were telling me about the microphone thing. This is a great little facility you have here. Did I say I was an alcoholic? Okay. I am, trust me. And, yeah, I like the facility here. It's really nice. And I want to thank Zach for asking me to come over. Yes, October 2nd, 1989 is my sobriety date, so it was last weekend, I think I had my birthday, and it was a good week to have it because I had some time this week to relax a little bit. I'm self-employed and work gets busy sometimes, and for the last month and a half it's been just crazy, and so I had some time and had time to have some friends over for an afternoon barbecue in the middle of the week, you know, unlike normal stuff, you know, when you're just pushing and going, not complaining at all, because when I got here, I was unemployable. So about my story, it's always remained the same, other than there were times when I embellished some things and brought them back to a little bit more to reality, you know, as time went by, and I got some therapy and realized that some of the stuff that I was putting out there was kind of not right, and that my perception of life when I got here was so askewed that it made no sense at all. But I was, I'll just start at the beginning like always, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I love Porterville. I've lived in Porterville and in several different fashions during my drinking career. I never lived here when I was sober. My son lives here today. My grandchildren live here. My daughter lives in Springville. I was born to my mother and my father, and they separated when I was five. My father was and is an alcoholic. He's 89, I believe, now, and he's still drinks and smokes, and I would characterize him as a lifelong alcoholic. And nothing has been resolved in his life. There are a couple of us children out of, I think, five of us that will communicate with him. The rest won't, don't care to. He was a violent, mean alcoholic. That was my early childhood. Watching my mother get hauled off in the ambulance into the hospital after the beatings and stuff. And then she finally separated from him, divorced him, and she went out and met this man selling Bibles in a bar. She married him, and that was my dad. My dad was a wonderful, wonderful man. My mother and my dad, for all of my time at home, I left home when I was 17 and a half. Were, I guess, what I will characterize as heavy drinkers. And everyone around me. I had uncles and visitors and people that were around my childhood that were heavy drinkers, as I'm not supposed to diagnose anyone. But I can tell you that on the grocery list, there was always a gallon of something. And it always sat in the middle of the kitchen table. And there were good times and there were bad times. And I didn't know any different from normal living to living in that environment. I did have aunts and uncles that were functional people, real people, that lived in the same house all of the time, for years at a time, had jobs and stuff like that. My dad never mastered that part, and later in life he did, after he quit drinking. While I was at home and we were children, we moved constantly. 2 to 3 months was a good stay somewhere. And we would go to a town and find the most run-down house in town. And my dad would go to the courthouse, and we'd find out who owned that sucker. And he'd go knock on their door, and we would talk them into letting us move into it. And we would paint it and do all the, you know, stuff. Fix the toilets, whatever needed to be fixed, and that's how we would pay the rent. And when that was done, it was time to move on to the next place. And sometimes that would be in Oregon, California, all over California. Arizona, Texas, Oklahoma, and it was just constant, and that's the way I was raised. But he was a wonderful man, so was my mother, and today I know that they did the best they knew how to do, you know. And but to get on to me, you know, living in that environment, I am a child of the 60s, and I had determined that I was never going to be a drunk like them. And there were other things coming up in the world in that day. So I started imbibing in that. I had older cousins that, you know. So we would go off and do that stuff. But alcohol was always there. It was just always in the ground. It was always there. I knew early on that when I drank, that I drank differently than the people that I drank with. I knew early on that there was, I didn't know it was what's called the phenomenon of craving, that once I began to drink, that I just wanted to drink more. And that's what I did. And that's exactly what I did. Left home when I was 17 and a half. My parents landed. We landed in Visalia. And we were there. And I was in the last semester of my senior year in high school. And came home one day and the car was packed up again and they were leaving. Yeah, we were supposed to move again. And I didn't want to. And I had family here, an aunt. And I talked her into letting me stay at her house briefly. And finished school at Mount Whitney in Visalia. And immediately went to a manpower vocational training school. And met up with a couple of guys. And that began, to this day, a lifelong relationship with both of them. And an adventure in my life that lasted for the next 7-8 years of doing illicit drugs and things. And there were good times. There were good times, yeah. But I have to say that I left home when I was 17 and a half, moved in with that aunt, started that school. And by my 18th birthday on November the 15th, I was in bed on my 18th birthday kicking heroin. And that's, you know, just the way it was. And I continued that adventure. Went into that other thing, and there were good times. And when that part of that adventure was over, and I had backed away from the illicit drug business, I was left with tremendous habits and devastation in my life, and was doing everything I knew how to do to change, to make things right. during that period I had gotten in a relationship with this woman, and she had three kids and I had one, and she had four kids and I had one, and we had the little place with the acre and the cows and the horse and the birds and all that stuff, and I was doing everything I could possibly do to work an honest job and stop my habits. And just struggled and struggled and struggled, had no tools to work with at all. And of course that failed. There were more failures at relationships. You know, I kept moving on and moving on, thinking I can change this, I can fix this, I will do something different. And I knew nothing of the disease of alcoholism, that I was, as it says in here, powerless. Yeah. I was powerless. I had lost the power of choice. I did not understand my affliction, and I was doomed to repeat my behavior. I had learned poor living skills all of my life. I was not shown good living skills. I was taught by that dad many skills, and now I know it as child labor, but but he taught me many things. You know, I often today when I see a young boy, 12 years old in that neighborhood, I look in astonishment. He is one of our. My job, so I remember being, I think it was seventh grade, but my job was to, we would land in town. My dad would not only do the house thing, but then we would go to the car lots and find cars that were broke down and bring them home, and that was my job. I'd already learned how to work on cars. He taught me how to work on cars. So I would fix the cars, and my job would be to come home one afternoon. I'd do two cars a week, and I would get home and jack up a car, pull the transmission out, and take it to the basement or the garage and tear it apart, clean the parts, and then the next day I would come home, put the parts back in it, and then put it back in the car. And I could do two of those a week. Yeah. And then there was the time, I think, one of our... one of the struggles was that I was getting a little older, 15, 16, and I wanted, we had stopped, we were somewhere that I wanted to play sports in school. I wanted to go out for the baseball team. And we came home to ask permission to go, you know, to do the baseball team, but at that point in time, my dad says, no, you can't join baseball. He says, I need you here at home. He says, I'm going to teach you how to work on these wash machines and dryers. I said, I don't want to work on wash machines and dryers. And he says, I don't care. Yeah, and he explained to me, he says, you know, he says, you'll be able to go anywhere and create your own job. You will be able to have work. He says, everybody's either got one of these things or they want one. Yeah, and you will learn how to work on these. So that began my education in the appliance business. Washers and dryers and refrigerators and TVs and all that good stuff. And that was, you know, how I contributed to the household. And at that point also, I was getting a little older, and I think my first car was a 52 Chevy. And I'd saved up enough money, you know, that allowed me to save up enough money. I think it cost me $200 or something. And that was my first car. And I hated him for it. I hated working on those things. You know? I can tell you that later in life, it saved my life. It allowed me to live, both in the disease and after I got sober. It put me through college. Yeah. And so that's where that was, you know. But I was on my own then, in creating the havoc, destroying my life and the lives of others, the ones that I would get close enough to hurt. And it was, I would always be back and forth after I left home. The disasters, the divorces, the accidents, the all of the things in between. When there was no place left to go, I would wind up back at mom and dad's. Yeah. And And so by the time I was 30-ish, something like that, my parents moved here. My mom and dad moved here to Porterville. And my mom quit drinking altogether, and a few years later, my dad quit drinking. And so I was back and forth, and I was doing work with him. He had an appliance business here in town, and it was going pretty good, and so I would always show up and earn some money. And then another adventure, another marriage, and that failed. And I had moved over to Visalia, and my father, my dad, had started a real estate business, and we were doing real estate, finding old houses. You know, any town there was, find an old house that sits on the ground, and you jack it up, and you put a foundation under it, and you do all the stuff, you get all the permits, and then you turn the house over, and you make a few bucks, hopefully. Yeah. And I had gotten married again. In 1980, I was living in Visalia with my daughter, single parent, drunk single parent. A neighbor had approached me. She knew of the disease and said to ask me, told me that she would take care of my daughter if I would just go get some help. And so I checked into Pine, recovered there in Visalia, and I stayed about probably 15 days, I think it was, and I ate some food, you know, got to where I could sleep right. And one day I was in a class and somebody asked Frank Ross if he'd ever seen anybody get sober without God. And Frank paused for a minute and he said, "No, I don't believe I have." And so that set me on the course of thinking. I started thinking, well, this is not where God lives. You know, these people, these guys I'm hanging out with here in this place, they're all criminals and thugs and drunks, and you know. And it was my excuse to make my flight out of that place. And so I left, and I believe I came back to my mom and dad's here in Porterville. I'm sure I did. Because by that time, my dad had quit drinking and had become an ordained minister. and he was going to this Baptist church over here. So, well, I figured I would go find God with the family. And went and got baptized and all that good stuff. And found myself drunk shortly thereafter. You know, afflicted with a disease that I'm powerless over. And went on some other adventures and wound up back here for some reason. I don't know exactly how it all turned out, but I wound up back here and I met this girl, and she was from Springville, and so I was going to marry her. And she was a regular church attendee at this church, and when the elders of the church found out she was going to marry somebody, they approached me, you know, and wanted to know if I had been baptized yet. And I said, "Sure, I have over there." And they kind of said, "Well, maybe that didn't count. You know, in our church, you need to be baptized in our church, you know." And I had some conflicts with religion through the years, and that one set it off too. And anyway, I married her, and we have two children together. And shortly after the marriage, it became quite obvious to everybody around me that I had a problem, and I was being their problem. So once again, it was suggested that I might want to go get some help somewhere. And I wound up in a place called Teen Challenge, Shafter, California. Yeah, that place. And I was supposed to stay a year, and I stayed for 6 months, and I started thinking, yeah, I got this pretty much under control, you know, it seems all good, I seem good, I can go to church at home, you know. And we had found a house over in Farmersville, and we jacked it up and put a foundation under it, and that was my house. And That's where we lived. And so I was going to go home and everything was going to be good now. And shortly thereafter, I found myself drunk. 1986. And that was all that her family was going to put up with. And they came and got her and brought her home rightfully. And took my son with them. And so that left me to just... I had the best job I'd ever had in my life at that time. Great job. And making more money than I'd ever made. I'd come home and gotten a real good job. And they left, and I had a motorcycle at the time. And motorcycles and alcohol do not mix. And I left work one afternoon, and I still had lingering things with these other habits. And I left work, and I left Porterville, and stopped at the liquor store, threw down a half pint, came home to get other things that I needed for this other habit, and was going to go over and do that other habit, and decided, well, what the hell, I must as well stop here in town and get myself another bottle. So I drank that, and I was leaving Farmersville, and wrecked that bike, and wrecked me, and wound up in the hospital, and one more time, back on Mom and Dad's couch. This time it was an 8-month journey of letting them put things back together and learn how to walk and all that good stuff. And stayed there. While I was there, I was kind of okay because I was under sedation from the doctor. I had enough of some kind of medication to keep me immobile. And then one day, I remember I was leaving the doctor's office because I had to go get that prescription filled again. And I didn't have an appointment. I just needed the prescription filled. And the nurse came out and said, David, we're not going to fill these for you anymore. But as luck would have it, my liquor store, every good alcoholic has a liquor store, their own liquor store. Some people say they used to go from store to store so they wouldn't be recognized or people would think. Well, a real alcoholic has a store. When you walk in, they know what you're going to buy and they put it on the counter for you. And if you don't have the money, they'll give you credit till the next time you come. That's what, And I had one in Visalia, Tulare, and Bison, and Porterville. Remember the one in Porterville was just on the next street road. There used to be a little liquor store right on the corner there. And if it didn't matter, I'd come in and get myself a bottle. Didn't have to pay for it till next time. But anyway, at my mom and dad's house, there was a liquor store about a mile away. And so you would see me on a daily basis gimping it on down to the liquor store, And that's how my leg got strong enough to walk on. So I lived there, and things went on normal for me, normal. Like I said, my dad and mom, they had quit drinking years before that, and that wasn't normal for them, all through my drinking career, there were the times when maintenance was normal. Everything was good. I stayed on program. I did my half pint in the morning, half pint at noon, and I could drink a pint at night, and I was just cruising. That was my routine for life. Only every once in a while, and especially towards the end, I would get drunker than I should have. Sometimes on the same amount of alcohol. And sometimes I'd get drunk and decide that I could go get another bottle. And then I'd get real drunk. And the way my dad talked about it, one day he decided that he'd had enough. And I was well enough, I guess, he decided that. Because he asked me to go for a ride in the car with him. And so we got in the car and we started heading off, and he got out just east of Tulare. And on the way over there, he started talking about stuff, me, about what I do, what I don't do, and bringing up my drinking and stuff like that. Awkward conversation. And he did tell me he loved me. Yeah. And then he got to this stop sign east of Tulare there, and he just stopped and pulled over, and he said, David, I love you. He says, but you're like living with a time bomb. We just never know when you're going to go off. Yeah. And he says, I can't let you treat my wife that way anymore. And you can't come home no more. And that was it. I got out of the car and he drove off. And that began the last 3-4 years of my drinking career. That began the beginning of my homeless career, you know, where I began to find out the safe places to sleep, what an abandoned house looked like, and how to keep it looking like an abandoned house and no one know you're there. That's what the rest of it was. I'd used up relatives. Nobody wanted me around anymore. My brothers and my sisters, no family wanted David around. So I just vagabonded around. That began one of my stints here in Porterville. There was a secondhand furniture store just about a block, I think, down from the liquor store here. Right next to it was a set of cottages. And right next to that, just before the river, was a little bar. There were secondhand furniture stores everywhere, and I could make a living. I could fix a washing machine. I could fix a refrigerator. And did that for a while. That woman that left me, and when I was had the best job I ever had, and her mom and dad came over and got her. I was living here. They lived in Springville, and one day we crossed paths and. The old flame started up. I hadn't seen my son in a long time, so I wormed my way into that and swore to God I would never drink again. We were together for one night. The next night, I showed up drunk. I didn't see her again for 6 months. And I saw her again. She was with child. And so that's where my other daughter came from. But the relationship was not to be. I didn't see that girl for the first year and a half of her life. At one time at the hospital, they let me look through the window. And that's what I did to people. 1986, when she left and I wound up on the couch, I wound up homeless. That began the end of it. I got sober in 89. I was over in that area of the valley, and I wound up going to a secondhand furniture store east of Visalia. There was this old retired Nazarene minister that owned this secondhand furniture store. He had new furniture in there too. And he was my Eskimo in life. He saved me, and he allowed me to. There was an abandoned pump house behind the furniture store. Just a woodshed, holes in the wall and everything. But he said, he felt sorry for me. He said, you could stay back there if you want. And for the next 3 years, I pretty much stayed there. On my little jaunts, I would just decide that I'd go across town, sleep over there for a while. And I had my bridges picked out. I had a little place by the library downtown that was safe and warm. I had enough warrants and fines and stuff that I could go to jail for a month or so in the winter and get out of the cold, pay off the bills and stuff like that. And alcohol had led me to believe that it was okay to live like that and that I was supposed to live like that. I was going to drunk driving school during the end of that when I was out there trying to get my driver's license back. I don't know why I hadn't had a driver's license in years, but I wanted to have my driver's license back, and I kept going to this drunk driving school, and I couldn't make it. I just couldn't get there. I couldn't, because I'd get drunk, They'd keep throwing me out, sending me back to court, and I'd worm my way back in to get in there again. They even gave me the right to write my own excuses of why I didn't show up. And I couldn't pull that off. Yeah. It was just that. And but there was this fellow there, Jerry, working there. And every time I would come there, it was supposed to be like a 12 or 18 month course. And I was there for over 2 years. And but Jerry, every time I would come in there, he says, David, when you get tired of this, he says, you let me know. We'll get you some help. Yeah. And I'd say, I just got a couple more things to do, and I know I need to do something, but just I'll go take care of this stuff. And yeah, and one day they had thrown me out because I didn't show up, and I had to go to court to get reinstated, and court was in Dinuba, and I had already been to court many, many, many times in Dinuba. Judge Drew, and the previous time that I had been there, I went and I did my thing with the judge, and everything worked out fine, and all I had to do was go over and sign the piece of paper, and I could leave. And the bailiff was standing there, handing me the pen, and I signed it, and he just looked at me and says, if you ever come back into court looking and smelling like this, he says, I'm going to send you right back up there. And I knew he was serious. You know, he had my number. And so this next time they threw me out, and I'm going to have to go back to Dinuba and go to court. And I knew that if I drank, that guy's just going to lay dead for me. And he's going to put me in jail. And so I said, I'm not going to drink. But I had to catch the bus to get there. So I took the bus. Court was supposed to be in the morning, 10 o'clock. So I caught the bus. Went down to court, and something happened, and they couldn't hold the court that morning. They were going to hold it over till 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So I had to wait all that time. And I went to court. Judge Drew reinstated me and said, but you got to go back today, back to the driving school, and sign up again. And it was, I had to go back, catch the bus, and get back there in time, go in there, and sign up again. And it was like 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon before I got back to Visalia. And I'm an alcoholic, and I cannot not drink. And by the time I got back there to the drunk driving school, I was just a quivering mess. Yeah. I might also mention that by that time in my drinking career, my hair was falling out from malnutrition. I weighed about 137 pounds, I think it was, and I looked terrible. And I looked so bad. You know, that liquor store that I learned to walk down to, it was on Lover's Lane in Visalia. And it had gotten to the point by then that I would... Art Ward, my Nazarene minister, savior, that didn't believe in AA. But he, through the years, he figured out who I was and what was going on. So he would show up in the morning and he would give me my $5. And I'd go down and get myself a half pint and a pack of cigarettes. And then at noon, he would give me $5 more. And I'd go down and I'd get myself a half pint, maybe some more cigarettes or whatever. At nighttime, he would give me $10. I'd go down and get me a pint, 2 dark beers, and a pack of cigarettes. And that was my life routine. I was on a maintenance plan. And it had gotten to the point that when I went for my nighttime bottle and everything, that the man that owned the store that worked there every day just could no longer sell me my bottle at night. He started bagging up a free TV dinner. Because he just in good conscience was watching me die. So that's the way I looked that afternoon. Shaking, quivering, and sick. And this lady, Debbie, that worked there, she walked through the door and she just looked at me in disgust and shook her head. And she says, she cursed. And she says, aren't you effing done yet? Yeah. And took me in her office and she... I'm not sure if she fined me or whatever. I think she fined me, made me pay a thing, and then she told me I had to go to extra meetings, and then I did the usual thing. Like, I don't have a driver's license. She says, I don't give a F, walk. Yeah. And then she says, go see Jerry. Yeah. So I went into Jerry. One more time, Jerry says, David, if you're tired of this, we can fix it. I can get you some help. And I broke. I said, okay, I'm done. Okay, I give. And so he did all what he had to do, and then so I called Pine, and they, in their infinite wisdom, say, okay, now you can call us every morning, and when we get a bed, we'll let you know. You can come in. And so for 2 weeks, I faithfully cut down, and I was doing 2 half pints. Staying in the store, trying to stay safe, I'm going to do this thing, and kept calling every morning. No answer. And on September the 28th, is the evening, I had a drink, what I was going to drink that day. Everything was fine. I was sitting in the store. All was good. I was indoors and safe. And a friend stopped by, and he had a big bottle. And so that was the last night I got arrested. Because by the time we were done drinking that bottle, we decided we should go chase his girlfriend down, who was running in bars or something. We wound up in Exeter, and I got arrested again. So I went back to the routine of calling, nothing. And on October the 1st, 1989, I knew where the keys were. He left the keys in the truck there. So I just took his truck and his petty cash, and I backed that truck up to the door, and I loaded it full of furniture, and I headed off out to New London to get what I needed. And on the way there, I bought myself a fifth, and I knew if I got the right combination of things, because I had OD'd more than once, I knew what the combination was, that I could pull this off, and I did not have to do this anymore. There was nothing left, no one left. I was done. And alcohol had led me to believe that the world would be a better place without me. Something happened on the way. I think I got drunk. And because the next thing I remember is it's morning time. I'm at Cutler Park in Visalia. His truck is up on the road by the river with the door open. All of my stuff is on the seat. And a lawnmower is going to run me over. And so I called Art. Figured, okay, well, I'll just have the police take care of this. We'll get this, I'll go to jail. What the hell? I can't do this, right? And Art showed up by himself. No police. And here's this old man, he was gimpy, he had one bad leg, and he's up on this thing, and he's coming down this embankment, stumbling, and he's got a paper in his hand, waving it, and he, David, you'll never guess what? And I'm going, listen, I'm not in a guessing mood, And he says, they've got a bed for you. They've got a bed. And he's all excited, and I'm going, oh, shit, I thought I was going to go to jail and get the, And I said, okay, well, let's go back and get my clothes. Because I had a paper bag full of clothes. And he says, oh, no, your clothes are in the car. And he says, we're going straight there. We'll drop you off right now. And that began the great adventure. The adventure that I would hope that any of you guys, anybody here that is new, just getting started in this embrace with everything that you have. It changed an old hope-to-die junkie alcoholic. It gave me a design for living that helped me understand the disease that I'm afflicted with. It helped me to uncover and discover and discard the things in my life that were of use and were of no use. It led me through the process of, as it talks about in the book, smashing all of my old ideas, forgetting all of my conceptions about what religion were, what people were, what love was, re-identifying all of my feelings, because I was so full of fear. Anything in me by that time just welled up in fear. I didn't know how to love. I didn't know how to talk. When I got here, I was just a stuttering fool. People would talk to me in meetings, and that's truly all I could do, was stutter. And but it began that adventure, you know, and it's been a long process. The early years were quite an adventure. Today things have settled down and run quite a bit smoother now, you know, but it's all been tempered with the concept of a higher power. Yeah, truly important in my life is the fact that I have the ability, the faith, and the experience to pray to an unseen force, but one that I have experienced in my heart and in my life, and that I call upon a daily basis to lead me through my fears. I know when it's beginning in me. I still am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. I do not, you know, institute any chemicals of any kind in my body other than caffeine and nicotine still. I have done immense work emotionally on myself to find out who I am, who I'm not, who you are, who you're not, what power you have and what power you don't have in my life, in my actions. As I said, I truly believe, as Frank said that day, is that without a higher power, that I would not be sober today. You know, I did not have a true identification of that higher power for many years in recovery. I explored, I experimented, I searched. The secret is in the search. If you are searching, you are looking. And if you're searching, you're asking. And if you ask, it will be given. You just have to ask constantly. Yeah. And I did that. I did that. The stumbling blocks in recovery, the relationship things, the learning to be a productive human being and show up for work and do an honest day's work, the ability to not steal, in the real sense of me taking something from you physically, the ability to not steal your energy and your emotion and your spirit, the ability to at times separate myself from myself long enough to be able to actually recognize and know when I'm standing with someone who is in need of support without them saying anything. The ability to connect with another human being, which is truly the only thing that I believe that I have to offer. You know, the other night a fella, I hope I still have it. I know I put it in here, and I said, well, I'm going to carry that for the next year, because I always carry a chip with me, well, my birthday chip, which I need a new one now. But he gave me the one here that has Dr. Bill, Dr. Bob, and the fellow laying on the bed. Yeah, and that's our job here. That's my purpose in life. Yeah. It says in the book, my purpose in life is to grow in understanding and effectiveness that I might be of use to God and my fellow man. The thing I know the best is my disease. And that is what I have to give. And those are the people that I can touch and that can touch me. As many times as not is when I and making that effort, a conscious effort to do that, is when I receive my rewards. That is when I am given. And when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I never know who the student is and who the teacher is. I just know that I have to be there. Yeah. Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Changed a life that was totally useless. Everybody else had given up. Everybody. And then I gave up. To a place where I actually feel connected to the universe. I feel connected to you. Him. I know why you're here. Because nobody in their right mind would be sitting in here. You know? There's no reason to come here, you know, other than to try and search for the answer. And as long as you're searching, the answer will come. So never quit asking. You know? That's all I got. Thank you.